that have helped prevent tens of thousands of coronavirus infections, says Jake Johnson, writer, in an article published under the heading, 87 million Americans could lose paid leave without urgent action from U.S. Congress. Stay tuned for the details of this article. Without legislative action from a divided lame-dog Congress, before the end of the year, nearly 90 million public and private sector workers in the United States of America could soon lose federal paid sick and family leave benefits that have helped prevent tens of thousands of coronavirus infections. The federal paid leave benefits, mandated under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, that is FFCRA, are set to expire at the end of December without an extension from U.S. Congress, which thanks in large part to obstruction of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has made little progress toward another relief package in recent months despite the spiking COVID-19 cases and a worsening economic crisis. As Politico explained on Sunday, November 29th, Families First, a relief package enacted in March, required many employers to provide workers with 2 weeks of coronavirus-related sick leave at full pay and up to 12 weeks of family and medical leave to care for family members at two-thirds pay. Researchers estimate this covered half the U.S. workforce. But those provisions, which cost about $105 billion, are slated to expire at the end of the year, meaning that as many as 87 million public and private sector workers could be deprived of the benefit. It's very America for us to finally require paid sick leave and family leave during the pandemic, only to let it lapse before the pandemic is over, quipped VOX Dylan Scott. Even the limited paid sick leave mandated under the FFCRA, which denied benefits to workers at companies with more than 500 employees, prevented an estimated 400 coronavirus cases each day per state in the U.S., according to research published last month in the journal Health Affairs. Senator Patty Murray, whose attempt to amend the FFCRA to provide paid sick and family leave to all U.S. employees and independent contractors was blocked by Senate Republicans, warned of disaster if Congress lets the benefits expire at the end of the year. If you do not have paid sick leave, if you cannot take work off, you go to work when you're sick, Murray told HuffPost in a phone interview last week. One of the things that we know people need to do is to isolate themselves if they are exposed. That's how you stop the spread. But if you do not have any paid sick leave, you're going to go to work. You need to put food on the table. You need to pay your rent. In a tweet late on Sunday, November 29th, Senator Bernie Sanders echoed Murray, declaring, "No wonder should have to make the unacceptable choice of going to work sick or losing a paycheck." The HEROES Act, passed by Democrat-controlled House in May but blocked by McConnell, would extend the paid sick and family leave benefits through December of next year and expand the programs to cover workers left out by the FFCRA. If the U.S. Congress does not get its act together soon, up to 87 million workers will lose the paid sick and family leave they desperately need. We must expand these benefits to all workers. No worker should have to make the unacceptable choice of going to work sick or losing a paycheck, Bernie Sanders said. In addition to expiration of paid sick and family leave, around 12 million Americans are set to lose unemployment insurance the day after Christmas if Congress doesn't extend the crucial lifeline, according to a report by the Century Foundation. Many struggling Americans will lose access to aid at the end of December. Accountable U.S., a government watchdog group, tweeted on Monday, November 30. The Senate is passed due to on spending measures and more stimulus to help those hit hardest by the coronavirus pandemic. Looking at you, Senate Majority Leader, it added.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, is the world the final purpose? People sometimes have difficulty comprehending the nature of this world. They find one set of interpretations of verses and speeches commending the world and also its material tools, introducing it as a house of commerce or farm of saints. And then they find verses and speeches blaming it and calling it dangerous, deceptive, and source of conceit. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first infallible Imam, said, "World is created for another purpose, not for itself." So, brothers and sisters, we know that there are some contradictory verses, traditions, thoughts when it comes to this world. There's one set of people, one group, they say that world is something good. World is a place where you do good deeds, and at the end of the day, when you leave and depart this world, you get the benefit of those good deeds. But then, on the other hand, world is also known to be something that is lowly in nature. It provokes your worldly desires. It attracts you towards its, lights and its attractions, right? So which one of the two are correct? Is world really a praiseworthy place, or is it something condemnable? Is it something that should be forsaken and should be left behind? And, you know, when we read sometimes the stories of the sages of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the spiritual personalities, we see that their interaction with the world was very minimalistic. So which one of it is really true? ¶¶ Welcome back to your listeners. Today we've been discussing about this world. What is the reality of this world? Is this world a good place to be in? Is it something where we should have a healthy relationship with this world? Or is it something that should be condemned, that should be forsaken, that should be given up? And Imam Ali alayhi salam said that world is created for another purpose, not for itself. Well, this tradition clarifies the issue, indicating that when the world and its material tools are used as a means of attaining human development and justice and prosperity for all, it is to be valued and commended. But on the flip side, when it is considered as an end in itself, just for immediate and inordinate fulfillment of desires with no higher purpose, and causes rebellion, conceit, and obstinacy, it becomes hateful and dangerous. So, to conclude this thought, world enough in itself is not the goal. If someone, they were to take world as a means to achieve that goal, and the goal is perfection, self-development, the taqwa, the piety, reaching Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If somebody takes world as a means for all that, this person has done justice to this world. Otherwise, anybody who gets engaged in this world for the sake of this world and for the sake of his worldly pleasures, know that that engagement with this world is contemptible. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Scott Atlas had no prior experience in public health, but grabbed Trump's attention during his flame-throwing appearances on Fox News and joined the Trump administration as an advisor in August. Atlas proceeded to push a libertarian approach to managing the pandemic. He questioned the effectiveness of social distancing, considered widespread testing to control the virus unnecessary. All the while, he derided widespread closures and questioned the utility of mask wearing as part of an overall belief in the highly questionable herd immunity approach to solving the virus. At last, coronavirus views, as you may have suspected, conveniently jived with Trump's anti-science takes on all aspects of the virus. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading 268,000 Americans died And Scott Atlas shrugged. Trump's most dangerous COVID advisor quits. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Scott Atlas, President Donald Trump's favorite and most dangerous COVID-19 advisor, announced his resignation from his White House position recently, just days after his 130-day role on the coronavirus task force was set to expire, a move that was welcomed by critics who say the Stanford University radiologist's views on the deadly pandemic are inconsistent with epidemiological recommendations and harmful to the nation's public health. I worked hard with a singular focus to save lives and help Americans through this pandemic, Atlas wrote in his resignation letter. The coronavirus pandemic has killed more than 268,000 Americans, and NPR reported recently that since Atlas began his job in August, nearly 100,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the U.S. Slate summarized Atlas' tenure recently. Atlas had no prior experience in public health, but grabbed Trump's attention during his flame-throwing appearances on Fox News and joined the Trump administration as an advisor in August. Atlas proceeded to push a libertarian approach to managing the pandemic. He questioned the effectiveness of social distancing, considered widespread testing to control the virus unnecessary, all the while he derided widespread closures and questioned the utility of mask wearing as part of an overall belief in the highly questionable herd immunity approach to solving the virus. Atlas' coronavirus views, as you may have suspected, conveniently jived with Trump's anti-science takes on all aspects of the virus. Progressives characterized Atlas' embrace of herd immunity as not just highly questionable, but rather as a potential massacre that would require over 200 million people to be infected, resulting in millions of deaths, as Common Dreams reported in September. In his resignation letter, Atlas insisted he always relied on the latest science and evidence, without any political consideration or influence. As time went on, like all scientists and health policy scholars, I learned new information and synthesized the latest data from around the world, all in an effort to provide you with the best information to serve the greater public good, he said. Atlas claimed to have focused in particular on looking out for the working class and the poor. The U.S. has more than 13.5 million COVID-19 cases as of Tuesday, December 1st, and as Les Leopold showed in October Common Dreams essay, low-income Americans will bear the greatest burden as infections and deaths surge. He's an MRI guy. He has no expertise in any of this stuff. Dr. Ashish Jha, the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, told NPR. Despite having no background in infectious diseases, Atlas has been bringing out arguments that have been refuted week after week, month after month, since the beginning of this outbreak, Jha added. Matthew Gertz, senior fellow at Media Matters for America, illustrated one example of the clash between Atlas' anti-lockdown opinions and real-world evidence. On October 30, Atlas told Fox News, "All lockdowns do are destroy families, really kill people, and it's amazing to me that places, unfortunately like the UK and France, have not learned their lesson. Meanwhile, data comparing the three countries' trajectories completely undermine Atlas' talking points. He is a destructive force, a federal health official told the Daily Beast last month. I mean, at this point, I don't know how else to explain what he is doing. It's really disruptive. Trump's outgoing advisor took a leave of absence from his position as a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a conservative think tank at Stanford, to temporarily join the White House. The university has in recent weeks distanced itself from Atlas, especially after he called for an uprising against Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, following the Democratic leader's implementation of new public health measures last month.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamic.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, other life forms, you are listening to Youth Station.
Choo-choo-ka-choo. It's a youth station for you. I'm Muzaffar Haider.
And I am Zainab. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's show. There were a group of people. They were all handed balloons, like blown-up balloons. And they were asked to write their names on it and release the balloons into the room, mm-hmm. and like 12 people. And then there were maybe more, 25 people. And then they were asked to chase the balloon with their names on it and catch it.
Okay.
You see how sensitive balloons are? Like the draft that comes from your body pursuing it pushes it farther away.
Yeah. And it goes really high up. So like how are they supposed to, do they have ladders?
It was not helium filled, bro. It was just normal balloon blown up with a person's mouth.
Well, that's just silly. So they're just running around this room, like trying to
chasing their balloons.
Balloon on the floor.
Yeah, but when they stood, but when each of the point
did
is,
anybody
the more
bump
they
into each other?
It, they most probably did. It was probably embarrassing too. But the continuation of the story is not relevant to us. I'll tell it later. The point is, the more you chase something, it seems like the farther away it goes from you. Yeah.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said that the dunya is like your shadow. The more you chase it, the more it runs away from
beautiful.
You.
Beautiful.
The more you run away from it,
the more it chases
it
you. Yeah, that's beautiful. And that's exactly what it is. And that's exactly what I mean by let it go.
Uh-huh. Let it go.
Oh, my Lord. Frozen all over again. But I don't even like that cartoon. Oh, you've watched it a kajillion times on account of your daughter.
No. She ain't watching that.
My point is, let it go, you know, because I feel like life experience. The more we hold on to something, the more we have a sense of attachment to it.
Okay.
And the once we are attached to something, that bond is created, the higher are the risks of us losing it and getting hurt.
And of course, if you're not attached to it and you lose it, you wouldn't even notice.
Exactly. It's not like you never lost anything at all. Right? Mm. But I'm not so sure. I mean, it's really easy to say it in words, walk the walk, but to talk the talk. But can we walk it in real life? We're bound to get attached to things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's difficult not to stay detached from things. There are many, many different idols that people get attached to. And the biggest idol, according to the Ahadith, is the idol of the self, which actually is really interesting, going back to the analogy that you painted of the balloons that you're chasing, because it's got your name on it. You're chasing after you,
exactly. And we do it so discreetly sometimes. I was once a guest at a friend's house, and they legit walked out on me for a good hour because they had to go do their a'mal, Okay. It's understandable to an extent.
Wait, so were you alone in their house?
I was alone in their house for a whole hour.
Did you open their fridge?
No, I sat there and I played with my phone and I, you know...
Did they leave you with food?
There was some fruit on the table. But the point is they walked out on me for a whole hour. A friend that was dear to me and I hadn't seen for a really long time.
That's messed up, man.
It is, you know? And, okay, mm-hmm. When we say amal, exactly, and deeds and actions, it's all important stuff. I understand that. But were they doing it out of...
true servitude.
True servitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Or were they doing it to boost their spiritual ego?
Ooh, I didn't even think of that. I just thought they were being a bit rude.
It was rude. It was rude, and it was the whole spiritual ego aspect of it, and they walked out on me. I mean, I don't even care now. But it depends.
Which amal were they? Were they regular daily prayers?
No, it didn't. It wouldn't take...
Was it wajib?
There's no wajib in the world that takes for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a whole hour. There's no wajib in the world. And we've been told, like...
Hajj takes a pretty long time, though. I'm just saying.
I'm pretty sure they didn't walk out on me from the living room to the other room to perform Hajj, bro.
Right, yeah.
Okay, coming back to the topic of our discussion, we are talking about letting go. We're talking about how clinging on to something increases the risk of loss.
Sister, just off the back of that, it's so fascinating, right?
What?
So the biggest idol is the idol of the self, right?
Definitely.
And you've just given us an example of somebody abandoning their guest. You know, they should have prioritized you. I'm sorry that you had to sit there for an hour just on your phone.
I know.
But, you know, they did that, according to you, like just to boost their spiritual ego, which may well be the case, right? Mm-hmm. Why? You see, there's an important part of the Quran which is often neglected, and it's about migration.
Mm-hmm.
Migration,
okay.
Right? Leaving your home.
Yeah.
Right? Imam Khomeini talks about this in a beautiful way. And he talks about how it is talking about the physical migration as well, but it's also talking about the spiritual migration. And what the Muslim is supposed to do, the believer is supposed to do, is migrate out of the house of the self.
Allah, Allah.
Okay, and he says that unless you do that initial migration, unless you move away from the house of the self, all of your ibadat will be for nothing. And all it will be for is just, you know,
to boost yourself,
building up your nafs. Because you haven't even left your house yet.
SubhanAllah.
Right? So, I mean, yeah, that's what it's really about. The bottom line is... When it comes to letting go, we're talking about positive letting go.
Yeah.
We're not talking about letting go of iman. We're not talking about letting go of faith or anything like that. No, we're talking about letting go of anything other than God.
Letting go of exactly anything that will eventually leave you itself.
Wow.
SubhanAllah.
And while Allah can never
leave
you.
And Allah never leaves.
I'm going to cry.
I know.
The Quran says, وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ حَبْلٍ وَرِيدٍ. And we are closer to the creation than the life vein in your body.
It's so beautiful, right?
SubhanAllah.
What is the thing that you find yourself as I can think of like an array of things that you're probably attached to, but what do you think is the number one thing that you found yourself attached to? And God, if you lose it, it's going to like...
Oh, I think it's moment to moment, sister, because right now I am so attached to this coffee on my desk and this chocolate. I am just waiting to open this chocolate and eat it. Well, what are we not attached to? We're attached to our families, our friends. We're attached to our homes.
Would you say your children are your biggest attachments right now?
No.
If I'm
being honest.
What's your biggest attachment right now?
My biggest attachment right now.
Your second biggest attachment. You don't have to tell me your first.
Well, okay, negative attachment. We're talking about
negative attachment.
Okay, well, then there's loads. I can't think of the first one on the list. I think my biggest attachment right now is my pillow.
Sleep?
Yeah, it's hard to wake up in the morning.
How many hours of sleep do you get in a day?
Nowadays?
Yeah.
Five?
How much do you need?
Four.
I know people who can function more than well, you know, with 5 hours of sleep. It's just how they're programmed.
Well, recently, I mean, Allah has done a miracle with me. I've never been a morning person. I've hated waking up early. I have always needed my 8 hours of sleep. Otherwise, I'm grouchy to everyone. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, I'm sleeping less.
Okay, my biggest attachment right now, negative attachment. If I lose it, I might lose, like, my hat. My solitude.
Oh, you really like your solitude, huh?
So much. I've been loving quarantine. I've been loving...
Oh, my God, so have I.
...post-COVID world. Everywhere is so quiet. You don't need to socialize. You have a legit reason for not going to get-togethers. You know? I mean, it's so good. I mean, I'm naturally an antisocial person as it is. I actually once faked a death in my family to avoid going to a meeting. But my solitude... And why is it a bad thing? Because I feel that it's in community that you build yourself.
True, yeah, definitely. Right? Islam is a very social religion.
Exactly. It's in interacting with other people, having some people get on your nerves, you know, trying not to get it onto other people's nerves, trying to avoid haram looks, haram gaze, haram words, haram relationships that you grow, right? And I've been avoiding that so much to an extent that I feel if I lose my solitude now, I might lose my mind. And I feel that that's a dangerous attachment for me.
Wow, that's really, really interesting. Although it's kind of enviable as well, because a person's solitude, if they can be happy in their own company, then that's a really good sign. And it means that you can go and interact with people, which, as I'm witnessing right now, I'm sure you have no problems interacting with people, which is great. It means you can dip in and out. It's the people who are
genius.
Yeah, it's the people who are, you know, not comfortable in solitude that we're actually worried about, because people be committing suicide and stuff. COVID-19 started. In Russia, they were going to do a lockdown in one of the cities, and then they announced that, look, it's better if we just don't do a lockdown because more people would die from...
suicide.
Yeah, yeah.
Ya Allah.
The suicide rate has soared in European countries and in America as well.
Sad. And also Japan and Korea.
Japan, I mean, it was always already.
And I think one of the reasons is because they did not learn the concept of letting go and not getting attached to things that would leave them anyway.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, my brother once read a news for me that in Japan there was a teenage girl whose cat died and she jumped out of the balcony. And it's sad because that child, that teenage girl who could have had a future, who could have had a family, who could have accomplished so much in her life, was never taught the most fundamental thing to be taught about this dunya, which is the fact that it's fleeting.
Right.
It constantly slips out of your hands and fingers like a fish.
Like a fish.
Focus, right?
Why did you have to give that example of all the examples?
Have you ever tried to hold a flopping fish in your hand? You've never been fishing?
No.
That tells so much about you.
I have, but I never caught anything.
You've never held a fish?
I've held a live fish. A small one. They're really hard to hold, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or a bar of soap. You know, a wet bar of soap, you're trying to hold it. The more tighter you grip, it just slips away.
Out of your hand.
Yep.
And I think that's my mom would always buy us pets as children.
What pets have you had?
I've had everything from snakes to hamsters. My father hated it. That's not the point. I love you, Dad. But she did that because pets would die, right? And we would get, like, distraught when our pets died. But after a while, we got used to it. We'd bury it in the backyard. We'd get a new pet. We'd move on.
Right.
And now I deal so good with loss, even if it's the loss of a loved one.
Wow.
I know. I don't know whether it's the psychopath in me or it's the fact that my mom, she slowly and gradually but surely built that within us that nothing's meant to last. And even something that you get attached to it, like a cute kitten, ends up dying.
Yeah.
And you have to bury it with your own two hands.
If you say it in that way, even those kinds of attachments will eventually leave you. You're only left with Allah.
Whatever you can accumulate for yourself for your hereafter, that will last, you know?
Yeah.
Your car, as fancy and expensive and schmancy and shiny as it is, what lasts from that car is how many times you've picked up an old woman, you know, in the cold weather, a young boy walking home from school in the heat.
Giving your brothers and sisters a lift.
A lift, exactly. Volunteering and dropping
driven
children
to the
off. Driving to the masjid.
Or a protest.
Or a protest where you'd have to leave your car like 17 blocks from the protest because it's so crowded.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's what you do with that material fleeting thing that could last you in the hereafter that stays with you forever.
But otherwise, the material things themselves don't.
Never do. They never, ever, ever do.
So it's better to let go.
So even to our children. I'm sure your kids are lovely. Our listeners' children are lovely. But I sometimes feel the need to tell some parents that, you know what, your child, if they don't leave at 18, if they don't leave for college, they're going to leave when they get married. They don't leave for any of that.
Or worse, they don't leave.
Oh, there's that.
There is that.
That's even worse. It is worse. But like to doting parents, the fact that I understand the attachment you have to your offspring, it's as if you've got a smaller version of yourself. It's as if God has multiplied you in creation. And I understand that innate biological attachment that develops. Mm. It's meant to be there, you know, for our own and the child's survival.
But if you get too attached...
it could lead to your absolute doom.
And of course, you're not only going to damage yourself. You're going to damage the child. Yeah, the child's going to be depressed.
Yes, abuse isn't always, you know, belts and spatulas.
Yeah, sometimes it's smothering.
Smothering, there
and obviously, it's not just that. It's parents as well. Parents with children, children with parents. You're going to lose your parents. And your spouses.
Yes,
every relationship, in fact, this is something that I learned a little bit recently, but you really cannot be too attached to those around you, even your closest friends. And I think that as time progresses, especially in the era that we're living in right now, Allah is going to prove that to you so that you detach yourself from everything other than Imam is Imam.
Exactly. And Allah. I once came across his quote on Instagram and I found it so beautiful, and the picture was beautiful. It was a picture letting go of butterflies, and the caption said, "And God said, I will take from you until you learn never to hold on." That's what happens in life. The more you find the need to attach yourself to something, to find a sense of belonging, we don't belong to this world.
Yeah.
You know, the more you try to do that, the more you will lose, and the more you will get hurt, and the more life will suck. What did you want to say?
When a tragedy befalls you, you're supposed to say a verse from the Quran.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Right. We are Allah's, and to Allah we are returning.
Beautiful.
Right. There's a hidden philosophy behind this verse as well, if you allow me to abbreviate.
You're very allowed.
Thank you. So everything is Allah's and everything returns to Allah. So you've heard the saying, you know, what goes around comes around.
Mm.
You've heard this saying that, you know, that the idea of karma itself, you know, that, you know, if you do good, then good will be done unto you. That is hidden within this verse as well, these kinds of philosophies. Because what it's essentially saying is everything that you have is actually Allah's and it's going to return to Him. When you say something, a word comes out of your mouth, you've created something. If you have a child, you've created something. If you, you get married, you create a relationship. Every step of the way, we are actually creating with the permission of Allah, right? Ultimately, it's Allah who's doing the creating. But everything, whether it's our thoughts, our actions, our words, will also return to Allah.
On the Day of Judgment, they're given back to us.
Mm.
You know, مَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ خَيْرًا يَرَهُ وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ شَرًّا يَرَهُ. Whatever the smallest particle of good or bad that we do,
you will see
we create, we give it to Allah. On the Day of Judgment, Allah gives it what goes around, comes around. Allah gives it back to us.
Yeah.
And then we reap what we sow. And it's so scary. It's so scary, you know?
There's another philosophy in the Quran where it says that Allah buys the lives of the believers.
SubhanAllah.
Right? How can He buy something that already belongs to Him? This is how great Allah is. He's given you something that essentially doesn't belong to you. If you don't learn to let go of it, well, it's not yours anyway.
Exactly.
And yet that thing which Allah has loaned to you, He buys from you. And He says, give this life in my way.
Yeah, and He gives you something in return for something that wasn't even yours.
It wasn't yours. Look, whether you want it or not, life is going to leave you.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you can choose to give it up freely for the sake of Allah. And if you do that, you will have purchased something far greater.
Thank you so very much for being with us. It's time for us to let go of this episode of Youth Station.
Yep, we're going to let go gracefully.
Yes.
We're not going to try and cling on to this.
Exactly.
We're not going to try and stretch it on.
We're bowing out, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life.
that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has targeted more Chinese companies, accusing them of having ties with the country's military. China's top chip maker, SMIC, and oil giant, China National Offshore Oil Corporation, as well as two other firms, have been added to the so-called blacklist of the U.S. Defense Department. This comes amid escalating tensions between the world's two top economies on multiple fronts. China has slammed the move, saying it firmly opposes what it calls Washington's wanton oppression of Chinese companies. Beijing says the measure will severely harm America's interest and image. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman also urged Washington to, quote, stop abusing its national power and national security concepts to surpass foreign companies. Over the past weeks, several Chinese companies have been blacklisted under an executive order signed by Trump. Washington and Beijing have been at loggerheads over a host of issues ranging from trade, technology, security, human rights to COVID-19. That all intensified when Trump took office in 2017, with his administration launching a trade war with China, leading to a tit-for-tat tariffs measures. Since then, key Chinese industries, including telecoms giants Huawei and ZTE, as well as several social media apps, have also been targeted under different pretexts. Washington has also used the issues of Hong Kong and Taiwan to put more pressure on China. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. So why is the Trump administration keen on infuriating China? It seems the expanded blacklist is part of a bid to cement Trump's tough-on-China legacy before Democratic President-elect Joe Biden takes office on January the 20th.
I think this is definitely a part of a larger effort against China. The United States has to find another way of undermining China. Obviously, militarily, taking on China is a near impossible task. It would not be possible. The foot soldiers alone to occupy China just simply do not exist.
Relations between the world's two top economies have sunken to the lowest level since Trump's arrival in the White House. Just recently, even the Democrat-led House of Representatives passed a law to delist Chinese companies from stock exchange if they do not fully comply with the U.S. auditing rules, thus giving Trump one more tool to threaten Beijing before leaving office. But will Trump be able to inflict beyond repair damage to the Sino-U.S. relationship remains to be seen.
A deal is imminent. These are the latest murmurings to leak from the Brexit negotiations between the United Kingdom and the European Union. As we approach the 11th hour, differences remain, but the reality of the circumstances are becoming ever clearer.
We are negotiating, and of course I follow closely the process of negotiation, but we will see in the next hours or in the next days what will be on the table, and we will need to assess the situation. And this will be a question at the end of the negotiation. We need to decide, the member states, they will need to decide. Like the British side, we will need to say yes or no, and the member states will say yes or no.
If progress is made, all 27 member states have to agree and ratify the deal in the European Parliament. France, however, have been very vocal. If the deal does not suit them, they will veto the agreement and send both sides into a no-deal outcome.
France est attachée à l'intérêt des pêcheurs, est attachée.
France is committed to our interests. We need to prepare ourselves for a no-deal, meaning that on December 31st, we would no longer have free movement and free access to the British market and vice versa. But that's not what we desire. Negotiations are continuing as we speak, but I also want to tell our fishermen, our companies, and our citizens we will not accept a bad deal. If the deal does not correspond with our interests, we will oppose it.
While many see such sentiments as negotiating tactics, some believe France actually wants a no-deal outcome. Economically, they will be affected, but it will be the UK that will feel the impact the hardest. France still has free trade with Europe and all nations that have trade agreements with the Union. The UK, however, will be limited to World Trade Organization tariffs. In this way, a no-deal outcome gives France the opportunity to fill the void left by the UK, who will find themselves increasingly isolated. A no-deal can also lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom. This will significantly impact the global standing of Westminster, who have recently been overtaken by India in the global order of world economies. Economic forecasts put the UK at the bottom of the G7, with the pandemic having impacted the UK economy more than its neighbours. In this vein, a deal that will protect jobs and livelihoods is now more vital than sentiment and ideology.
A roundup of headlines from the past week in the United States. In Los Angeles, murders in 2020 are the highest in a decade. In Atlanta, murders are the highest in 30 years. Chicago just reported homicides are up 54% this year and 73% month over month from November 2019, showing that neither cold weather nor the second wave of coronavirus is stopping the absolutely devastating record homicide wave. The murders are almost totally confined to the poorest ghettos, mainly populated by African and Latino American citizens, and are mostly in urban areas, which usually have Democrat mayors.
I think it's bipartisan. When we have violence among the underclass, that's something that everyone's tolerated in the country for too long. We have one party that embraces gun rights, which happens incidentally to not be the urban party, and then we have another party that's very kind of gun phobic. But neither party gets to the root, and the root of it is insecurity.
Many believe the most basic function of any type of government is to provide physical security. Many also say that the tolerance of gang wars, shootouts with no consequences, and an underclass which essentially suffers from de facto segregation is a reflection of America's endlessly violent national history and foreign policy.
When you sow insecurity and violence and use violence as a method of settling disputes, then the same thing comes home. You can't cause havoc all over the world and drop bombs on 10 countries and not expect to have some retribution at home. So I think that we need to demilitarize our police. I think we need to demilitarize our society. I think we need to demilitarize our foreign policy.
Nationwide, aggravated assaults have skyrocketed about a third as high as homicides. Total crime numbers, including robbery, sex assault, theft, burglary, and murder, are down just 7% in places like Chicago in 2020, providing scant compensation for such widespread loss of life and increased feelings of insecurity. Many nations have kept their schools open despite coronavirus, but across the U.S., schools have mostly been shuttered, causing a rise in juvenile violence. About 350 children have been shot so far this year in Chicago alone. Perhaps because of the coronavirus and the highly disputed presidential election, the record wave of murders has flown under the radar of the national media, but they have devastated poor urban communities and will require years of healing, reconciliation, and investment. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs Javad Zarif attended the sixth edition of the Rome-Mediterranean Dialogues Conference, which is being held in a digital format from November 25 to December 4. This year, the initiative, promoted by the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and by ISPI, the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, has been focused on the topic Beyond COVID-19, Navigating Solutions for Post-Pandemic Times, featuring over 100 experts and political leaders. In his address, Zarif touched upon a number of issues of international relevance, spurred on by questions from Elie Gerrenmayer from the European Council of Foreign Relations and Paolo Magri, Executive Vice President of ISPI. The top diplomat opened with an update on the coronavirus crisis in Iran.
The situation in Iran is pretty bad. Unfortunately, we're suffering from something more than the rest of the world is, and that is an economic war. This is way beyond restrictions. The United States even prevents us from using our own money in different countries to pay COVAX for the vaccine. If they say otherwise, they're simply lying.
Later, the discussion shifted on the nuclear deal signed in Vienna in 2015.
Earlier this week, some of Europe's leading diplomats urged the members of the E3, France, Germany and the UK, to act quickly to set out a roadmap for Iran and the US to return to compliance with the JCPOA. There's a real risk, experts say, that the efforts can be disrupted by those forces who have been working hard to escalate tensions between Tehran and Washington.
The Europeans have not been able to implement their part of the deal. The Europeans say that we are in full compliance. They're simply not. Implementation, compliance, means that they have to have effects for these actions. And we don't see an effect. We don't see any European company in Iran. We do not see any European country buying oil from Iran.
Zarif also commented on the assassination in a terrorist attack near the Iranian capital Tehran of prominent nuclear physicist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The future of the Iran nuclear deal will also be discussed with the European Union High Representative for Foreign Affairs Josep Borrell on Friday, the final day of the conference. Max Civili, Rome.
The fallout from the British government's decision to begin mass COVID-19 vaccination next week continues. The EU is certainly not happy about the move, and comments made by a government minister on London's LBC radio have only fueled the flames.
We've obviously got the best medical regulators, much better than the French have, much better than the Belgians have, much better than the Americans have. That doesn't surprise me at all, because we're a much better country.
The head of the European Commission's media service has been responding.
We are definitely not in the game
of comparing regulators across countries, nor on commenting on claims as to who is better. This is not a football competition. We're talking about the life and the health of people.
The British Education Secretary's remarks haven't gone down well either with members of the public we have been speaking to in Brussels.
It's ridiculous and stupid, and this guy is not worthy at all. So why they want to put in confrontation with the EU authorities? So is just to provoke more tension among the population or what?
The EU's regulator for vaccines is the European Medicines Agency. It wanted the UK to wait for its approval, given that Britain is still bound by the Brexit transition period. Authorities in Berlin are pointing out the vaccine that will be rolled out in the UK was developed by German firm BioNTech using EU research funding and is being produced in Belgium. Citizens we have been talking to believe the British government is trying to make up for its disastrous handling of the pandemic.
Now to do this step, to be kind of the first to do it, so I don't think that it's well thought through either. It's just maybe it's like a PR move. It's a move from the government to show, yeah, we have it under control, but in the end, I don't know.
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides says the delay in approving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is about winning the public's trust so that they actually take the jab.
The European Medicines Agency says it will make a decision on the authorization of the Pfizer vaccine by the 29th of December at the latest. But is this bolstering the EU's credibility in the eyes of citizens or eroding it? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca announced that Turkey will start distributing coronavirus vaccine after December 11. The minister said the Chinese vaccine, which Turkey had already made a deal to receive, will be given to all citizens in a four-phase scheme. The first phase will include health workers and senior citizens, as well as people with disabilities. The second phase will cover those with crucial and necessary jobs and citizens with chronic diseases.
We will be delivered at least 10 million doses of the vaccine in December, and this could go up to 20 million. Another 20 million doses will be supplied in January and 10 million in February. We want to increase these numbers.
Turkey made an agreement with China earlier to purchase 50 million vaccine doses. Turkey will be among the first countries in the world to begin vaccinating people for the coronavirus. With the first shipment of vaccines it has purchased to arrive in Ankara sometime after December 11.
I won't take the vaccine because I do not trust the results and it's not made in Turkey. I think they need to do more testing before giving it to citizens.
This comes as others cannot wait to get it.
Of course I will take the vaccine. I trust our government and its decisions. I'm tired of this whole corona thing.
Turkish president announced Monday a series of measures and restrictions to reduce the number of infections, such as imposing a daily curfew that starts at 9 p.m. and ends at 5 a.m., as well as a total lockdown during the weekend. Citizens and business owners argue that the closure and lockdown measures are affecting the economy.
We are abiding by all the rules, wearing masks and observing social distance, but this closure is affecting our business. Turkey's economy is already in a bad shape, and now with the new restrictions, things will get even worse.
Meanwhile, main opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu criticized government's way of handling the coronavirus crisis, saying the measures taken by the government negatively affected the economy, as well as harmed medium and small businesses. He also accused the government of lying about infected and death toll numbers. Rehşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The French government has launched a new wave of measures in their effort to combat so-called Islamist separatism. 76 mosques up and down the country have been flagged as potential hotspots where extremist ideologies are being peddled.
There are a few mosques which are against the French Republic, where the imam is already being followed by the security services, places where the teachings are against male and female equality. There's a hatred of Jews and Christians, a hatred of France. They have suspicious foreign financing. People there make excuses for terrorism. From today, we will begin our investigations to remove any doubts, but if our suspicions are confirmed, we will close these mosques down.
Darmanin also announced the deportation of 66 undocumented migrants suspected of radicalization. In the past few weeks, France has enforced the closure of the Muslim charity Baraka City, as well as the civil rights group, the Collective Against Islamophobia in France. Amnesty International described the move as shocking, with a chilling effect on all groups trying to battle.